Hello, and joining you 3 days before a Vuelta a España that promises to give us three grand tours in one by biting off a chunk of the Giro and a morsel of the tour. My name's Daniel Freiber. I am the host of this special preview episode of La Vuelta, in which we'll try to establish what Italy, France, and Northern Spain, only Northern Spain, have in store for us over the next 3 weeks. Joining me to do that today is one member of a sprawling squad that we'll be deploying in the aforementioned countries. It is the Great Dane, Brian Nygaard. El Barón.
El Barón.
I guess you become the Vuelta.
I like that a lot. Gracias.
Brian, you are a member of the... I'm going to talk through the squad and how the squad rotation is going to work in just a minute. With Brian and me, though, today, I'm also unveiling a new signing. Yet more young blood in our roster. His name is Daniel. But his surname is Arribas. He is formerly of Relevo, soon to be, I think he's already started, in fact, at El País, the August, a very distinguished Spanish newspaper. And Dani Arribas is a sort of Fran Reyes with an equally sexy voice, but minus the cartel moustache, which is good news for all of us. Dani Arribas, we're going to hear more about what brings you onto our team in a moment. But first of all, how are you, Dani? And where are you?
Very good. I'm here in Madrid where everything is going to end next September. And please don't wait a very sexy voice from me as you have with Fran last year.
Well, no one can live up to that, can they? Unfortunately, Fran can't join us this year. I don't know if we've revealed on the podcast yet, but Fran has another job currently. And let's say the gamekeeper turned poacher, or the poacher turned gamekeeper. He's done something. He's kind of gone in the opposite direction to what you did, Brian, to your trajectory.
Oh, so he's gone to the other side.
Kind of. I won't elaborate. But unfortunately, Fran won't be joining us. Who else will be joining us, though, over the next 3 weeks on the Vuelta a España? We are going to have Michele Pellacci on board again, the young Italian stallion's probably the wrong word, but the ham impresario, the king of prosciutto, who you all enjoyed, I think, during the Vuelta a España. We've got Michele also because, of course, the Giro starts in Italy. I'm also going to export him, take him over to Spain, mainly for the purposes of critiquing the jamón, but he's going to be on board for the first week. Second week, we're going to have a bit of a hybrid setup. It's going to be mainly you, Brian, but we've also got Lucky Larry Warbass dropping in, of course, a Tudor Pro Cycling rider. He is not riding the Vuelta a España this year because his team is not riding the Vuelta a España, but he will be appearing for the cycling podcast. And then to help us land the plane and arrive in Madrid, it's Danny. You are coming on board for the last week. Lionel will be assisting as ever on the sidelines. And I should also take this opportunity to thank Lionel, Graham as well. And Brian, I know you've been appearing as well for the fantastic job they've been doing over the last few weeks. Lionel needs a rest because he has been on it for quite a long time now, since the start of the tour. But Lionel may be dropping in as well over the next 3 weeks. But Danny, back to you and your debut appearance on the Cycling Podcast. Of course, you're going to be our resident Spaniard, our resident sort of home turf expert over the next 3 weeks. But tell us, first of all, a bit about yourself. Tell the listeners a bit about yourself. How did you come to be... well, one of a very rare breed, a young journalist working in cycling.
It is indeed. Well, I would say I started working, in fact, in El País, where I'm working right now, like a couple of years or 3 years ago, let's say, covering the main name there in El País covering cycling, which is Carlos Arribas, as probably many people know, which, by the way, is not part of my family.
I'm not. That's important to establish. Yeah. He's the kind of eminence grise of Spanish cycling journalism. One of the greats, Brian, you would agree, wouldn't you?
Absolutely. Legend.
Absolutely. And yeah, I started covering what Carlos did not cover at the time. Let's say the first Tour de France Femmes back in 2022, I think. But yeah, of course, my background, my cycling background was starting many years before, probably when I was a child in the first part of the century, with those Spanish victories of Contador, Sastre, Pereiro, and all those years. After that, let's be honest, I kind of disconnected a bit of cycling, probably during the Sky era.
We had this conversation the other day. I think that's probably quite common among non-Anglophiles.
I'm not proud of it.
Yeah,
I'm not proud of it, but I don't want to not tell the truth to the listeners. And yeah, probably back in 2020 or something like that, I reconnected with the sport that I fell in love when I was a child. Start covering it, so working on it and trying to do my best since then.
And Danny, as I said earlier, well, you're going to be our sort of Spanish specialist, Spanish correspondent. We're going to talk a bit later about the Spanish challenge of the Vuelta a España. It's not a particularly strong one, I must say. No Enric Mas, but we will be discussing that later. What we're going to do is, in the second part of the podcast, we're going to be mainly focusing on the route of this Vuelta a España. Vuelta route that covers or dips into four countries. We didn't mention Andorra. Should have mentioned Andorra in the introduction. So we're going to focus on the route in part two. And then in part three, we are going to talk about teams and team news. We haven't got all of the team lineups, I don't think, yet, as we go to press, as it were. But we do have most of the team lineups. So that is what is going to happen, but we will reconvene after the break.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode is sponsored by NordVPN. Daniel will soon be off to Italy, France and Spain for the Vuelta a España, and I know he'll be using his NordVPN account. And I'll be at home and I'll have my NordVPN account switched on my laptop, tablet, phone, and in fact, our internet router, protecting all of our connections when we're at home. So why do we choose to use NordVPN? Well, in my case, I became a NordVPN subscriber a number of years ago, long before they first started advertising in the cycling podcast. My primary reason was internet security, making sure that my connections are safe from hacking or phishing attempts, as well as keeping me safe from viruses and malicious malware. One NordVPN account can be used on up to 10 devices, so you can have the peace of mind knowing you're safely negotiating the online world, whether you're home or on the move. The most important data to protect, of course, are things like bank details and passwords, but it's also important to protect your online identity, and NordVPN offers you that security. There are other benefits too, such as watching your favourite sporting events or streaming services, even when you're in another country, simply by switching your virtual location. All of our listeners can get a great discount on a NordVPN plan by going to nordvpn.com/TCP. If you use our unique link, which is in our show notes, you'll get 4 months extra free when you sign up for a 2-year plan. There's no risk either with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. So go to nordvpn.com/TCP today to get yourself a great discount.
From a point of view, people don't know a lot of about the Vuelta history, but from a point of view, La Vuelta has a very rich, not only history, also very rich prehistory. When Tour of France started to be the very beginning moment of the 20th century, a few years later, some people here in Spain start to think about something similar here, a kind of Vuelta.
Well, chaps, the voice we heard there was another friend of the cycling podcast, a Spanish gentleman called Juanfran de la Cruz, and he's an author. He's probably the foremost Vuelta historian. He has written a book that's recently come out, excellent book it is, in Spanish, called Crónicas sobre Ruedas, which is about the first 90 years of the Vuelta a España. And we're going to be hearing more from Juanfran about his book later in the Vuelta a España. But the youngest Grand Tour, the Vuelta a España. Intriguing history, chaps. Speaking to Juanfran, I mean, I didn't know that much about the genesis of the Vuelta a España, the origins of the Vuelta a España, and I didn't know much about this period before the first Vuelta in 1935, when there were various attempts over about 20 years to start a Vuelta a España. And it was kind of a little bit like what you see now with Strava, for example, people undertaking these kind of DIY challenges where, I don't know, they paint a cat on the using the roads of San Francisco or something. And people had seen what was happening in Italy with the Giro. They'd seen what was happening in France with the Tour. And various people in Spain did try to prove to the world, to the country, that it was possible to ride around Spain on a bike. But it took a long time for these efforts to come to fruition in the form of an actual Vuelta a España. However, fast forward 90 years, and we will be starting this year for the sixth time. The Vuelta will be starting for the sixth time in another country, and it's the first time the race will be starting in Italy. Now, Brian, this seems slightly incongruous, does it not? Particularly at a time when you and I have heard this ad nauseam over the last few years, and we've often said it ourselves, that Italy is not exactly thriving as a cycling nation. So why the hell is a region like Piemonte hosting the Vuelta a España?
Well, I mean, if Italy is thriving or not, that's hard to say. It certainly isn't with cycling, but Italy wants to embrace cycling, and if Italy really owns something in terms of equity for cycling, it is races, isn't it? And it's the presence on the calendar of races, I suppose. And we saw the same thing with the Tour, didn't we? When the Tour started in Florence, it also passed this way, on its way to France, and I suppose quite similar way through the Alps. I quite like it. It's sort of, when you talk about the Vuelta, this year's Vuelta at least, if you don't look at the map, you still think of it as a Vuelta. But when you sort of look at the map and you have to sort of zoom in and out to look at it overall, it's not really a Vuelta of, it's not really a Tour of Spain, isn't it? It's an air transfer and then a trip around northern Spain and then down to Madrid of sorts. One thing though, Daniel, when I look at the start, it is also with a bit of a sentimental feeling, because that part of Italy reminds me of a former lost friend, Gianni Savio. This is really Gianni Savio country, and how much he would have loved to, you know, his affinity with the Spanish part of cycling, Southern American part of cycling. He would have absolutely loved to have seen that as well. Not only did he miss the Giro start in Turin of sorts, he also certainly also missed the Tour start when it happened there. So, yeah, that always makes me sad to think of. But it's a varied start, you know, and I like that it starts also differently with a flat stage, and it starts, you know, specifically also with a harder stage in a fairly known alpine region of Piemonte.
Yeah, we'll get onto the stages in a minute, but I just wanted to ask Danny, someone is from neither country, how would you characterize Spanish-Italian relations? Because in a cycling sense, again, going back to my conversation with Juan Fran about the history of the Vuelta, another really interesting moment, and one we're going to talk about later in the Vuelta, is the moment 30 years ago, exactly 30 years ago, when the Vuelta changed dates and it moved from April to September. And so in April, May, it used to take place. It sometimes, there were some editions where it even overlapped with the Giro, but it was certainly an uncomfortable coexistence of the two races side by side. But at this moment in 1995, when the Vuelta changes dates, the option was there for the Giro to be the one that changed dates and to go to August, September. And the answer that came back to the UCI from the Giro organizers was, we can't possibly do it because the mountains are not accessible at that time, which I don't know where they got that from, because it's probably the best time of year to hold a grand tour on the highest mountains in Italy. But also, you know, we've been around longer. We've got a more glorious past than the Spaniards, so you're going to have to move. And the Vuelta did, and it's turned out very well for the Vuelta. That's another story. But in terms of just the countries themselves, one thing I always think about the Spaniards and the Italians is sometimes they're a little bit too similar, and therefore they don't really coalesce very well.
Yeah. I don't know if we... I have like a... let's say, a different perspective. I get we are very similar. It's true. But we have this kind of inner competitions in ourselves to not be like the other, let's say. Because it's funny, because when you were saying this background of La Vuelta that you talked with Juanfran, back in the day, the riders had to make their choices to which Grand Tour they're doing. And it's kind of funny because today most of them has to still choose which one are riding, because probably most of them are riding the Tour, so they have to choose the second one between Vuelta or Giro, even they're not on the same part of the year. But yeah, it's, I think, of course, the Giro has a little bit more history, the history is there. But Vuelta is always trying, no, to recover that space, to have like its own history, its own essence. Recent years, we've seen a very specific way to do it. Probably we're going to talk about it in the stages. But yeah, I think we have very similar or common things between us. But we always want to have our singular essence to bring up.
I have a question for you, Daniel.
Yes.
Yeah.
Having a free, sorry.
Danny one or Danny Daniel, two? Yes.
Well, I don't even know which one of us is number one. But Freebie, so you've traveled obviously extensively in all three countries. Don't you feel that Italy has more of an affinity with Spain than it does with France? That the Italians tend to like the Spanish people more than the French?
Yes.
Or maybe just because the French are the neighbors?
I think definitely so, Brian. One exception to that is the region where the Vuelta is starting, Piemonte, which has historically been linked with France. And you find people, well, historically people in Piemonte have even spoken French. So that is one exception, I would say. But yeah, there's a sort of common enemy sandwiched between those two countries, which is France.
Yeah,
certainly. The Italians can be pretty sniffy about the French, which is ironically what they say the French are towards pretty much everyone. And that's the main bone of contention, isn't it? That the French are arrogant. That's a sort of Italian stereotype.
I just made you say what I think.
There you go. Anyway, without further ado, we should move on to stages. So chaps, I'm going to do a quick run through of week one, then we're going to pause and you're going to tell me what you think about week one. So the Vuelta a España starts from Venaria Reale, which is just outside Turin, and it goes to Novara. This will be a sprint stage, I think. Venaria Reale, that's where one of the many, I think 15 residences of the House of Savoy was. House of Savoy, the last monarchical rulers of Italy. Fascinating story. They were exiled for decades when Italy became a republic. If you want to learn more about the House of Savoy, I would recommend watching the Netflix documentary. I think it's called The Prince, which was released in 2023. Novara, home of Beppe Saronni, illustrious former Italian rider. That will be a sprint stage, as I say. Second stage from Alba, home of Matteo Sobrero. He'll be riding for Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe, and it's going to Limone Piemonte. Brian, you might remember this because Ivan Basso won a stage of the Giro d'Italia just above Limone Piemonte on the Col de Tondo, Colle di Tenda in 2005. That's 9.8 kilometers at 5.1%. It's a summit finish. Stage three.
Didn't the tour finish there as well?
In Limone Piemonte. Possibly. The Giro also finished there in 2002. Stefano Garzelli won before he was kicked out of the race because he failed a dope test. Stage three, San Maurizio Canavese to Ceres. Canavese is this area to North Turin where double Giro winner Franco Balmamion, the eagle of the Canavese, was born. Our good friend Herbie Sykes wrote an excellent book about him. That's a sort of uphill finish, but 2.6 kilometers at 3.6%, not very steep, probably a Mads Pedersen day. Stage four, Souza to Voiron. We're now in France. The race goes into France via the Mont Genèvre, the Lauterets, which of course is sort of three quarters of the Galibier. But the summit of the Lauterets is 130 kilometers from the finish. It's a largely flat running. Stage five, we finally arrive in Spain via a 4 hour plus transfer. It's a team time trial, 24.1 kilometers in Figueres, which was the hometown of Salvador Dali. The start ramp is in the or outside the Dali Museum. Unfortunately, this year we haven't got a start inside a supermarket, of course, which occurred last year. That was somewhere in Andalusia. I can't imagine, thinking of Salvador Dali, I was trying to establish some sort of link with professional cycling. I couldn't find one, but I can imagine Marc Soler appearing in the background of a Dali painting somehow.
Figueres is also where El Bulli was, the world-famous restaurant.
We will not be going there, Brian.
well, it closed many years ago.
Oh, did it close? Okay.
Many years ago.
Team time trial. Last team time trial in a Grand Tour, chaps. Can you remember when it was?
Yeah, last Vuelta Barcelona.
Correct. Yep. Also in Catalonia, 2023, that famous, infamous team time trial that finished sort of in the dark, won by, can you remember?
DSM.
Very good, Danny. Very good. and it ended with that famous tirade from Remco Evenepoel, did it not? Sort of foul mouth.
Oh, yeah, that's tirade. Right. Yeah. With the headlights, yeah, almost. They needed like the car lights.
First. He was pissed. Yeah.
Stage six, we've got the obligatory incursion into Andorra. It's the first mountain stage. We've got a Cat 3 climb, Cat 1, the Collada de Toses. After 66 kilometers, then La Comella. Little appetizer for the first Cat final climb, which is 9.6 kilometers at 6.3%. Stage seven starts in Andorra and finishes at Cerler, Huesca La Magia. Cerler, a very regular fixture in the Vuelta in the late 80s and 90s. Tony Rominger won there. Chava Jimenez won there. Excellent views up there of the Aneto, which is the highest mountain in the Pyrenees. And this is probably the hardest stage yet. 4,210 meters of climbing. There's a first Cat, second Cat, and then a first Cat to finish things off. 12.1 kilometers at 5.8%. Stage eight is devoid of climbs and it finishes in Zaragoza. Zaragoza, incidentally, where that 1995 race that we mentioned a few minutes ago, the first of the new era for the Vuelta, beginning in September, that was where that year's race started. But it is flat, a very flat stage, stage eight. And then stage nine, we've got another uphill finish to the Valdescarre ski resort in the Sierra de la Demanda in La Rioja. The final climb is 13.2 kilometers at 5%. So, chaps, just summarizing the week, four mountaintop finishes, one hill sprint. That's what I think will occur on, is it the second day in, no, third day in Italy, three sprints and one TTT. Brian, what do you make of that start? Four mountaintop finishes.
Yeah, I love it also because I feel like there's a lot for all the big names to really already grab a chunk of world of fame. We'll see. Well, I really feel it's going to be a bit of a Mads Pedersen show from the beginning on. Not that that's a measure of ultimate measure of power, how he dominated the Tour of Denmark, but he is in absolute peak shape. He's in just as good shape as we saw him in the Giro, and when he's at that level, he's gonna, I think, dominate. I wouldn't even rule it out that he could be in there on some of the climbs. He is in such good shape, and I think with the some of the other GC riders maybe wanting to take it a little bit more easy, I don't really see them going all out on, for instance, Limone Piemonte. And I'll be very, very curious to see the time gaps on the team time trial. So I think we're going to be, could be a few surprises also in that first week. I'd be quite curious to see how, especially Visma Lisa bike will tackle it tactically from the start. So yeah, I really like it because it's varied. You know, we'll see some cards on the table, but I'm not 100% sure that we'll see full dominance or try to see full dominance from Visma from the start.
Yeah, what's nice is there are quite a few stages there with a question mark over them, I would say. On, for example, the stage to Limone Piemonte, you might see, and even the stage to Ceres, you might see Vingegaard winning that stage, for example.
You think so?
I wouldn't rule out. Danny, what are your first thoughts?
Yeah, I do agree with Brian. At least for the first, let's say, five stages. I mean, the Italian stages, because I think the GC riders are probably going to take it easy there. But I don't know from there, because probably the first couple of mountain stages in Andorra and Cerler, which are, as you said, one of those iconic climbs La Vuelta has recovered this year for the 19th edition. I think those couple of stages are the very first point of the race where we are going to see the time in the GC break up for probably, I don't know, if just Vingegaard or any other rider. Let's see. But yeah, I'm very looking forward to see those stages, and probably the first stages in Italy are going to be more competed, let's say, like that.
We'll talk a bit more about the specifics of who has been selected later on, chaps, but I'm really intrigued by the team time trial and Visma Lisa bike in the team time trial, because they've had a bit of a mixed year in time trials. There was, of course, the day in the Tour de France where the team, apart from Affini, the team performed pretty poorly, Jorgensen and Vingegaard. And there were sort of some murmurs after that stage, particularly from Jorgensen, about them having got the setup wrong and the strategy wrong. And it's going to be, I'm going to be very curious to see how they perform. And similarly, UAE, they generally go well in time trials, have gone very well in time trials, but they've had the odd off day as well this year. And
they have a strong team for this one, though.
Yeah, but there is going to be a lot of speculation, and we'll get to this later on, about Juan Ayuso. And whenever Juan Ayuso is in the UAE team now, we all sort of speculate, and there's a lot of conjecture about how he fits in the team, how well liked he is in the team, and how harmoniously the team is going to work together. And that might be a topic of conversation on that day, particularly if things don't go well. But we shall see.
I mean, if they can't figure it out on 24 kilometers, then it's going to be a long welter, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Week two, stage 10 is another uphill finish at Larrabellagua, which was the scene of Remco's resuscitation in 2023 after that terrible day, that capitulation on the Tourmalet. He won the next day, long breakaway with Romain Bardet, then dropped him on the way to Larrabellagua. That climbs 9.4 kilometers at 6.3%. Stage 11 is almost a facsimile, an exact copy of stage one of the 2023 Tour de France. Some climbs there in the sort of hinterland around Bilbao that are very familiar by now. Morga, Vivero, Pique, 3,185 meters of climbing. That'll be an intriguing day. Stage 12 from Laredo, still in the Basque Country, to Los Corrales de Buelna in Cantabria. There is a nasty climb, 7 kilometers at 8%, 20 kilometers from the finish. Corrales de Buelna was the hometown of Jose Antonio González Linares, who has a velodrome named after him in that town. Famously once beat Eddy Merckx in a time trial in the Tour de France, I believe. Stage 13 doesn't really require any introduction or presentation. Cabezón de la Sal to the Angliru. The Angliru was often preceded by the Mosqueta and Cordal climbs. They're both sort of steep 20-minute efforts just before the Angliru. We are in Asturias. We're still in Asturias on stage 14 to La Farapona, famous Vuelta climb. Been used many times, preceded by another famous sort of mise en bouche, the San Lorenzo climb, 10.1 kilometers at 8.5%, then La Farapona, 16 kilometers at 5.9%. David Gaudu, of course, won there in 2020, but that year the start of the stage was significantly harder. Stage 15, we've got a transition stage with, good chance for Mads Pedersen, I would suggest, but also the breakaway could have a chance that day. It's quite a difficult start. Two big climbs in the first 55 kilometers. And that concludes week two. We've got three summit finishes, two punchy stages, I would say, Corrales de Buelna and Bilbao, and one breakaway or sprint stage. Chaps, the 2 days in Asturias, the Angliru and La Farapona, it's hard to see how they won't be pretty decisive.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Those days, I think I'm gonna arrive with the GC times always settled for that time. But in that second week, I have a feeling that we're going to have like very good highlights before the Asturias stages. Especially, I'm looking forward to see what happened in Bilbao, which has been like in the last years a very special place connected with Sagan, not just La Vuelta but also with the Tour. But yeah, Asturias stages, of course, for the GC riders are going to be hectic from the beginning, from Cabezón de la Sal in Angliru and Aviles from Alto de la Farrapona. But I don't know how you see it, Brian, if the times in the GC are already being take before those stages in Asturias.
Seeing that it depends, because I think Vingegaard will be as ready as he'll ever be. He'll be super strong. I see him as the overall favorite with no real worry in terms of competitors. That doesn't mean it's a walk in the park for him, but I really see him as the overall favorite without any doubt. It's just a question of how early he wants to flex that muscle. But they will have to, I think, put a marker down on the team time trial. And he will have, I think, an established lead after the team time trial, but he will have to go out and defend it. And I think I see him as winning on the Angliru as well. And then the question is then how strong will he be how far will he be in the lead after Angliru? And then I definitely see it as a ceasefire after that in that rest of the remains of the second week. It's just hard to predict, really, isn't it? Will or can UAE play two cards? You know, can they somehow maneuver the team in a way that they could put a threat on him by having more than one rider in the mix? He can even follow more than one attack and then still win. So, I mean, it's hard to really project or have any hypothesis of how he's going to race, because even if he has a slender lead after Bilbao, he'll still be expected. And I think he will want to win as many stages as possible. I really think it's his redemption at this Vuelta to try and win as much as possible. And I think he's really keen on doing that as well.
The narrative, of course, on the day that the race goes to the Angliru will be all about Vingegaard and redemption for Vingegaard after he was sort of stabbed in the back, I suppose, to some extent by Roglic. And well, no, it was really Sepp Kuss, wasn't it, that was stabbed in the back? But Vingegaard was a sort of an unwitting,
accessory. The knife went through and then went all the way into Vingegaard as well.
Yeah, but who knows? I mean, it would be great. I'm sure they would not agree. Elise Spike would not agree, but it would be great if we got a scenario like that, because that particular storyline in 2023, that was one of the more sort of succulent storylines of the last few years. So Roglic, Kuss, and Vingegaard. Of course, it was Kuss in the end who prevailed. He is on the start list, incidentally, but I don't think he'll be going with GC ambitions. Week three, we will run through next. Stage 16, Poyoto, Mos, Castro de Erbil. This is very close approximation, or very similar to what we know now as the Superman López stage in 2021, the stage where Superman López, remember him, he sort of threw a strop and, well, he got off his bike, didn't he? Got in the car and left, not in the Vuelta a España, but left his contract with Movistar. Very, very similar stage, not identical, but almost identical. It was sort of a Galician Liège-Bastogne-Liège kind of profile. Punchy in a similar way to the Bilbao stage as well. So that's going to be an interesting one. Stage 17 to the Alto de Moredero. And this is a fascinating one because this is a ski resort in El Bierzo, famous wine producing area, Brian. It's now defunct, the ski resort. It hasn't been open since 2008, so I don't really know why they're going up there. But it looks a fascinating climb, 8.8 kilometers, 9.7%, which is extremely steep. The Vuelta has been to the top a couple of times before, but via different roads. Roberto Heras won in 1997, and Alejandro Valverde won in 2006. Stage 18 is a time trial in Valladolid. I mentioned the 2023 Vuelta a España won by Sepp Kuss. There was a time trial in Valladolid that year as well. Then it was 2 kilometers shorter, so 25 kilometers that year, and it was won by Filippo Ganna, who was also on...
That is really the wine stage, Daniel, I'm sorry.
There you go. Mm-hmm. He's also Ganna on the start list this year for a race, of course, beginning in his home region, Piemonte. Stage 19, Rueda to Gihelo, 161 kilometers, completely flat, very high as well, chaps. Spends most of the day close to 1,000 meters in altitude. Reminded me of another bit of a Superman Lopez stage. Stage 17, 2019 to Guadalajara, where there was a bit of beef, wasn't there, between Movistar and Superman Lopez's Astana team at the time. Superman Lopez, what was the comment? Los mismos tontos, the same idiots that they always are. Because they, what did they do? They attacked when the race should have been neutralized, something along those lines. Maybe I'm getting mixed up, actually. Maybe that was another.
I think I remember that. Wasn't there crosswind or
stage
something?
Stage 19. The one, Guadalajara was won by Philippe Gilbert, and Nairo Quintana got back a lot of time. Maybe that wasn't the Los Mismos Tontos stage. Maybe that was the following day. Anyway, stage 20 is the sort of typical stage 20 that we often get on the Vuelta a España. Typical Sierra de Guadarrama stage. So those are the mountains to the northwest of Madrid. The difference this time is that the stage should finish on top of the Bola del Mundo, which is a very steep sort of concrete adjunct to a famous pass, the Puerto de Navacerrada. But the Bola del Mundo is a road that goes up from the summit of Navacerrada to sort of, it's a military station, isn't it? And it's extremely steep. The Vuelta has been there a couple of times before, 2010, 2012. But there's also some controversy already about this stage. Danny, you might be able to update us on this. There's been quite a lot of opposition to the race going up there from environmental lobbies. What is the state of affairs? Because there had been talk that the stage might even get shortened and it might finish on Navacerrada.
Yeah, especially from the farmers of the area and that kind of workers that are especially having his cows or whatever over there, just as usual. And yeah, they're complaining about the La Vuelta finishing there this year. But to be honest, I don't think the stage is going to be shortened. Let's see, because we never know. It's almost a month for that stage to come, but I don't know. Let's see. We saw this year in the Tour de France something similar, not in very particular the same thing or the same reason, but let's say related reason to shorten a stage. So let's see.
You never know. You never know with modern cycling, do you? Stage 21 is the now traditional time-honored procession into Madrid. The Tour de France has jettisoned its procession into Paris, but not so the Vuelta. Danny, I'm just thinking, actually, is there a hill in there isn't really a hill in Madrid. There isn't really an equivalent of Montmartre that the Vuelta a España could use, is there? Not really.
We were talking.
Wasn't there a hill at the world in the world in 2000?
Yeah, it wasn't. It was on the what's the fame of the Castellano or the
Casa de Campo is called. It's like the very big park we have here in Madrid with a lake and whatever. But it's a place I usually go with the bike, and I let's see. It's just like the steepest climb on that area is like a kilometer and a half at the 5% or something like that. So it's not that hard for the race to go there, and the surface is very comfortable. It's not like Montmartre. So yeah, we were talking about this the last day of the tour by social media with colleagues and other guys, talking about if we have the chance here in Madrid, or at least in Spain, to have something or a way to end the Vuelta in a similar way. But I don't see it. I'm from Madrid, listen, but I think the aura that Montmartre has this mm-hmm. year showing in the tour is something that we cannot have an aspiration for emulate. So yeah, I see like the last stage in Madrid is always the same or almost the same. I remember when it ended in the Bernabeu Stadium in 2003, I think. But yeah, it's something that we have to work on here in La Vuelta.
No more Montmartre. Well, chaps, I'm just going to summarize that week quickly. So I think that week we have got one punchy stage, two hard summit finishes, one TT, one sprint. And I'm putting the stage 19 down as a potential crosswinds stage, because when you get into the sort of middle of Spain, there's a breadbasket of Spain and those high altitudes around about Rueda, there's always the chance of crosswinds. So that concludes our roundup, and that sort of brings us to our overall verdict on the Vuelta route. The Vuelta route, we talked earlier about the Giro in relation to the Vuelta, and one thing that I certainly find still is that the Giro has a slightly easier, identity to kind of nail down, and the routes are slightly easier to read, mainly because your sort of eye is always drawn to the big mountain stages. You know exactly where they are. You know where they're coming in the race. You know they're going to come in week three. So it's very easy to establish sort of like-for-like comparisons through the years. You know, what was this year like compared to the previous year and the year before that? And I find that more difficult with the Vuelta. My first instinct when I looked at this route was that it's a sort of a diminuendo almost, that the week one is almost harder than week two is harder than week three. I think the stages in Asturias, Farapona and Angliru probably give lie to that. They probably ensure that week two is the hardest week. But in recent years in the Vuelta, week three has sometimes felt a little bit, not so much when you're on the race, but when the route is announced and you look at the profiles, you think, is week three a bit of an anti-climax there?
It depends on what's going on in the race, doesn't it? I mean, I suppose now that Pogacar isn't riding it, it leaves out a certain element of drama that could maybe have been dragged into the third week. Maybe or maybe not. That's, again, this projection. But I suppose I don't think anyone has. I mean, we'll talk about that eventually, I suppose. But even without those last 2-3 kilometers of Bola del Mundo, I don't think anyone entertains any doubts that the Vuelta will probably be decided before stage 20. Mm. But even still, in the preparing for this, you asked us what is the stage we look forward to the most. That is still the stage for me.
Mm.
Because I love that layout of that stage. I love how they're all up on the plateau, and there's, you know, these really hard climbs, and how the climbs are positioned throughout the architecture of that stage is, you know, it's really great. So yeah, who knows? But I agree with you. You often get the feeling that there's something missing in that last week. You know, it's not a real crescendo towards.
Mm.
Towards a grand final, and but especially not when you look at the start list.
I think the race benefits from it, because we've bemoaned a lot, Brian, in recent years, and I would still bemoan the fact that the Giro is too backloaded, and that has a negative effect on the first 2 weeks of the race. And in the Vuelta, you don't get any of that. There's no question there's no question that people can wait until the third week.
Yeah, yeah. So they're forced out of their, even if that's the case, their comfort zone. Everyone has to show their cards quite early. You know, there's no waiting on Angliru. So we'll have a little bit of an idea, I suppose, or maybe even a stronger day after Bilbao. But no one can be of any doubt of where people are after Angliru, regardless.
Yeah, I do agree, guys, and even more because the last Vuelta last year, the thrilling was given by the riders. I mean, by the advantage Ben O'Connor got in the first week, not by the course or the path. So I do totally agree with you, Daniel, and with you, Brian. And I don't know if you guys see this year an opportunity to have that Ben O'Connor-esque lead out from the beginning of La Vuelta.
I think it's always possible at the Vuelta, isn't it? Also because, and we're going to come on to this in a minute, I think there's always a bit of ambiguity about who is and who isn't going for GC and therefore who is and who isn't dangerous. And a rider like Ben O'Connor, for example, again, it's not entirely clear whether he could be a threat for GC or not. And also, of course, the teams themselves are a bit of an unknown quantity. I don't think the riders themselves won't know how strong their own team is and how capable their own team is of defending a lead, for example. I think Vingegaard knows that his team are going to be strong. I think Ayuso probably knows, but there are other teams in the race who, you know, I don't want to say they've been cobbled together, but they're a bit of a motley assortment of riders, and that creates uncertainty and it creates excitement as well.
But also, one thing worth noticing, the longest stage in the last week is 167 kilometers. It's wow. Quite significant.
Mm. That means some lie-ins for those of us who are on the race. That means some mornings mornings by the pool.
I've been looking at the transfers also. I mean, that Vuelta looks like a daisy.
Yeah. Particularly, I was very aggrieved, Brian, when I looked more closely at the Italian stages, naively. At first glance, I thought that the Italian stages would be very easy logistically because the whole of the first three stages was in Piemonte, even the start of stage four. However, we go all over the bloody place. There is no logic to it whatsoever. So, and those are going to be long days. But just as a final point on not so much what's going to happen in terms of the race, but geographically, chaps, the areas that the race is going to cover, it won't have escaped anyone's notice that southern Spain has been completely snubbed. And this is not the first time this has happened. Well, it happened in 2020, for example, the COVID Vuelta a España, and it's happened before as well. Danny, I don't know if you know, if you can enlighten the listeners on the reasons for this. Is there any particular reason other than the fact that it just so happens that this year the bids came from there and that was the easiest route for the organisers to knit together? But also, chaps, how do you feel about it? It does leave me, as much as, you know, I like the fact that we don't get the Dust Bowl Vueltas that we got year after year in the 90s. And I like the fact that the race has kind of leaned into northern Spain more and more because I think that's where some of the most interesting racing is. By the same token, sometimes it doesn't really feel like Spain when it's, well, I say when it's sort of green Spain. However, we also know that the backdrop of this Vuelta a España this year is the terrible forest fires in the north of Spain. So the idea that, you know, Asturias, Castilla y León, and these regions are always rainy and always humid, and it is green Spain. I mean, that is slightly outdated, that image as well. But just, Danny, on the Vuelta being confined to northern Spain, what would you say?
I don't know if there's, well, no, I don't know. I know there's not an official statement on this, but I get from my point of view, it's a way to have like the balance from the last year's Vuelta when we started in Portugal. But after that, like the first stages in Spain, as you guys know, were with let's say Stephen Heath, with the stages reaching very, very high temperatures in average of, I think, even more than 40 degrees. So
and we complained. We did complain about that at the time. We complained to Javier Guillen and we said that, look, this is in 2025. This doesn't work anymore because it's too hot.
Yeah. The south half of Spain has, of course, this geographical problem, if we can call it a problem, but and the north half, especially the north, very north part of Spain, doesn't have it. And but the second reason is, of course, what you have already said with the mountain stages that the Vuelta or the course can draw on that part of the country. It's very difficult to reach that difficult in the south, taking out probably Sierra Nevada, Granada, and those stages. So I think those two reasons are the main reasons for La Vuelta to have this like change between one year and another. And let's see if this year we don't have that death hot that we have last year in 2024.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Well, chaps, that absolute floor filler, that absolute belter is another of the official, in fact, the most recent official song of the Vuelta a España, this year's official hymn, song, anthem of the Vuelta. The artist is Antonio Orozco. And the title is Te Estaba Esperando. I was waiting for you, literally. It's kind of, I was expecting you. I was waiting for you. And I thought it would be appropriate to hear that. Also because I've developed this slight obsession with the official songs of the Vuelta over the last few years. And also because it's very fitting. I was waiting for you. I was awaiting you. And that could be directed at Tadej Pogacar. We thought that this would be the year when Pog would grace the Vuelta with his presence for the first time since 2019, when, of course, he burst onto the scene, winning three stages. However, no Pog this year. Anything to say, chaps, before we move on to who is here, particularly more maybe about the prospect of him sort of scratching this itch at some point in the near future? Is this ever going to happen? It's got to happen at some point, hasn't it? He's got to win the Vuelta at some point. But we sort of sense that he has this real appetite for the classics. He has this real appetite for the races he hasn't won, particularly Milan-San Remo. And the way he's been talking over the last couple of months, Paris-Roubaix as well. If he does those, can that be reconciled with a race program featuring the Vuelta a España ever?
Yeah, but I can't see why it couldn't.
Okay, let's move on.
Might have to sacrifice. Yeah, there you go. It might have to sacrifice. It could be in a year where, even if it's hard to really imagine a world's course where he couldn't put himself forward and win anyways, but let's say for the sake of argument that he skipped his Italian campaign in the autumn and didn't go for the worlds, and you know, with the upper hand that I think he still has, and now I have to be careful what I'm saying, over Vingegaard at the Tour. So, I mean, potentially he can...
You need to be very careful.
I am.
Based on what I've heard, based on the rumour on the Copenhagen streets, Brian, you need to be very careful.
I am. So, but what I'm saying is that I don't see that... Of course, it's not impossible for Pogacar to structure his season doing the spring classics. I mean, it's common knowledge, I think, that a lot of riders sometimes do the Welter for the sake of the Spring Classics, right? They do it to shoehorn themselves into the next part of the seasons, the next part of the season via the Welter. So I don't think the Welter does any harm for the Spring Classics the year after. And I think if he comes out of the tour, knowing that he doesn't have to go for Emilia, Trevalle Varesine, Lombardy, and the Worlds, I think the mental burden of all that, with that being gone and having, say, the Worlds as the last race of the year, I think that mental burden will be pretty easy to cope. Well, not easy, but it's for, you know, he can deal with that. And then having the Worlds as the last race of the year and then coming into the next year with a relatively clear head and then gunning for the Spring Classics, I couldn't see why that's an impossibility in any way, shape or form.
He's sort of sacrificed the Vuelta on the altar of the Worlds, in the sense
well,
that...
Well, the Worlds being the Worlds this year, I think that makes a lot of sense. But I also feel like he sacrificed the Vuelta for personal reasons in the sense that he'd been away a lot and he hadn't seen his fiancée a lot, etc., etc. So there's a lot of moving parts in this, I sense.
Yeah, yeah. Slightly disappointing that we won't see the Pogacar Vingegaard duel. I don't think that was a factor. Knowing that Vingegaard was going to be there, obviously the Vuelta presented a stiffer challenge than might have been the case in another year when he might have felt he could go to the Vuelta under or overcooked and still won. Also, there's the whole sort of narrative. A lot of his kind of boredom and his sort of fatigue at the Vuelta. You know, some of that will have been around the constant questions about Vingegaard, the constant questions about the team's tactics in relation to Visma Lisa bike. And I just think if he had gone to the Vuelta, a Vuelta with Vingegaard there, the whole experience would have been fraught in the same way that the tour was fraught and heavy and burdensome. Not like, for example, Brian, we were at the Giro last year when, okay, you know, there as well, there were stresses when he went to the Giro, but they were sort of minimal compared to what he faced at the Tour de France. But if he did go into a Vuelta that was billed as the big sort of rematch with Vingegaard, I think it would have been quite a stressful experience. So, yes.
Yeah, and I would even say if he went to the Vuelta without Vingegaard, as you mentioned also, you know, even if he wasn't on full firing form, he could have basically had it in the bag midway through the race and tapered all the way through to Madrid and had been ready for the Worlds. Completely different scenario, yeah, basically.
Exactly. Brian, before we get on to the other GC contenders, I just want to ask you about Jonas Vingegaard. The team's been announced. Obviously, it looks a very strong team. Jorgensen's there. I mentioned that earlier. And so is Sepp Kuss. But I think the difference this time, if you remember when Sepp Kuss won, Primoz Roglic was even going into that Vuelta saying that Sepp Kuss could win. No one really believed him, but he was right in the end. But I don't think there's any ambiguity this time, Brian, about there being a single leader of Visma Lisa bike. Am I right?
No, I mean, especially because of what happened back then. You know, they know that now. And they also... I don't think they underestimate, they will also be quite dangerous, I think, to underestimate UAE going for this now. And, you know, if they really pull this off, the combination of winning the Giro with Simon Yates and then doing this with Jonas Vingegaard will actually mean that they've, I think, saved their season in a way, even if they didn't pull off re-winning or, you know, coming back with Vingegaard at the Tour. So I think they have a lot going for this. So I think any ambiguity or any kind of internal, you know, they don't need that at all. They really need to go out and win this, and they need to go out and pick as many stage wins as possible in the process. So I think they know all of that, and they don't need to look like a team that doesn't have their all the eggs in one basket in the process, for sure not.
And especially, Brian, because I think in 2023, when that happened, Vingegaard came to La Vuelta after winning his second tour in a row, and now he's coming from his second runner-up tour in a row. So it's not the same to let a teammate, let's say, to have that that moment in La Vuelta that probably Vingegaard wants that redemption that Daniel was talking in before.
He needs it in a completely different way now. And the team needs him to do it in a completely different way now. I'm not saying that he's at a turning point, but I really think for a lot of reasons that it's important for him in a different way than it was back then.
Absolutely.
Brian being very careful today. Very careful. Very careful. Let's hope, Brian, that what you say on this podcast is not translated into Dutch, then translated from Dutch into Italian, then translated from Italian into Danish, and then translated back into English and used as a stick to beat you.
I can hear them gathering below my balcony.
Yes. Yes. Danny, before we speak about the other GC, possible GC contenders, I want a Spanish angle from you on two things. One, Movistar is the home team par excellence, always in the Vuelta a España. However, there's been a lot of talk on social media and in the media, the mainstream media, about Movistar's weak, very sort of insipid looking vintage as far as their team is concerned this year, because Eric Mas is not there. They don't really seem to have a GC leader. In fact, they've tried to, I think, present a couple of riders with GC leadership and they've not wanted it. Romo is one rider who has said he doesn't want GC leadership, but he's been given it anyway. So I wanted to ask you about Movistar. And also, if there is a big Spanish hope, it is undeniably Juan Ayuso. But we're sort of in the dark about how Juan Ayuso is going into this Vuelta, what kind of form he's in, what kind of spirits he's in. So those two things, please. How do you see Movistar and how do you see Ayuso?
Yeah, there's a paradox right now with Movistar, because the feeling inside the team is that they are doing great in the last Grand Tours, especially in the last tour, when with Romeo, with Cortina in the first week, with Enric Mas doing another thing that he's used to do. But the paradox comes when you see the points, the UC points, and when the team was one of the worst teams of the tour in that terms. So when they got the absence confirmed of Mas for this Vuelta, they came back for that idea of hunting stages. They called up Pablo Castillo, which of course we know what he did last year with two stage wins in La Vuelta, but also Cortina with the Tour on his back, also Cepeda, Aular for the sprints. I don't know. I think they have to kind of confirm the feelings with results, which is not easy, of course, but they're not in a bad mood, if we can say it like that. But time's running, so I think it's a very probably a turning point for them, not for others, to make this Vuelta special, especially in its home country, of course.
Yeah, it's difficult to see where their success is going to come from. I mean, I'm just looking at Castrillo, of course, one of the breakout stars of last year's Vuelta, and I mean, we could spend another 10 minutes talking about Kern Pharma, who are not going to be at the Vuelta this year, having won three stages last year. But Castrillo's already got 64 race days. He already did the whole Tour de France. He did the Tour de Suisse as well. So I think that it would probably be unwise to expect too much from him.
I think so, because when he broke out the Vuelta, the last year's Vuelta, he was, of course, with Kern Pharma preparing the whole year, the whole season for that chance, for that Vuelta to come. So it's, of course, so different. This year, I think his main goal was the Tour, to help the team in the Tour. That is already in the past. So this Vuelta is what happened many times with the La Vuelta. That is something that you have to show. It's a place where you have to show your level when the main goal of the season is already on your back. So it's kind of difficult. But yeah, I think Castrillo, of course, is a big hope for the team. That's for sure. But I do agree with you that it could be difficult for him to show up.
It's almost like Movistar have forgotten that the Vuelta is in September now. I still think it's in. I hope someone's told them.
No, I do think they have. I do know, in fact, that they have all the hopes in Enric Mas' shoulders. So what happened this year with Enric Mas in the Tour was, of course, unexpected for them. I don't know if they had this plan B or if they had any plan B, but they came up with this one. So let's see what happened.
There's always Valverde. Bring him back. I still wouldn't rule that out one day. I saw a headline yesterday that Nicky Terpstra was coming back to Sudal Quickstep. Yeah. And for a second, until I translated the Dutch headline, I wondered whether it was as a rider, because he's in pretty good shape. But no, Nicky Terpstra is going to be member of the management, I believe, in future. Danny, just quickly on Ayuso as well. Yeah. What news of Ayuso? Because he's been keeping a fairly low profile, obviously continuing speculation about his future, the fact that he's now enlisted a new agent, Giovanni Lombardi, who we know well. I expect Giovanni will be at the Vuelta a España. Difficult to get too much information. He's one of those agents, so it's difficult to get too much information out of, although he's a very affable fellow. I doubt that if he will reveal to me or to us that he is trying to get Juan Ayuso out of his UAE mega deal, but that is one of the storylines that continues to get peddled. But what do we know about Ayuso and how he's coming into the Vuelta? He's raced twice only since the Giro, once at San Sebastian and one at Getxo.
Yeah. The only thing that we know about Juan Ayuso at the moment, well, not at the moment, from the moment we knew Pogacar was not doing La Vuelta, which is the moment that we knew Ayuso was doing it, is that he's very locked in the idea of coming finally with a very good Grand Tour. He didn't come up with that level that we all expected in the last Giro. Of course, not the best luck, but we know that these things can happen to GC riders. And he's so locked in the idea of doing a very good Vuelta. One example is that he's not doing any interviews from the moment the Pogacar just came with the news that he was not going to La Vuelta. It's something that is not that common in Ayuso, which is a guy that it's very used to talk with the media, at least here in Spain.
Yeah, he's also a very good communicator.
Of course he is. Yeah. And he has a very way better English than I have. So, and the other thing is that we heard the great Eddy Merckx talked about Ayuso and those third weeks of Ayuso's in the Grand Tour. So I don't know if Ayuso has this in his mind. I'm pretty sure he has heard about what Eddy Merckx has said about
him. Remind us what Eddy Merckx said.
That Ayuso is not a rider with that, let's say, that gas tank for a third week in a Grand Tour. I don't know if that's true, but of course, Eddie come with this quote after the Giro, which of course was not a very good third week for Juan. But of course, Juan has already several podiums in La Vuelta, so I think he has this opportunity to show that he has that in his legs. But of course, he's in that point, as you have said, we don't know how is the real deal in the team with him, with Almeida riding, with not Pogacar riding any race, not just La Vuelta, any race with Juan Ayuso from many months to now. I don't know.
Danny, I'm going to have to march you off to Corrections Corner, because he's only had one podium at the Vuelta, and he's only had one podium in the Grand Tour. And that was, lest we forget, when he was still a teenager, 2022, long time ago now. Interesting sort of career arc since then. And it's interesting.
It was close. He was fourth.
He was fourth the following year. But as time goes by, that 2022 Vuelta a España, I certainly wouldn't belittle it, but Remco Evenepoel won that Vuelta a España, and as time passes, I think people might have a slightly different, nuanced view of the quality of that Vuelta a España. It certainly wasn't the most mountainous Vuelta a España. It wasn't the most mountainous last week, and Juan Ayuso's third place there, of course, when he was a teenager, made people assume we were in that period where sort of teenagers or guys who were 20 and 21, i.e. Pogacar, Bernal a few years earlier, had been just bursting out all over the place, and it was easy to assume that Ayuso was destined to win a Grand Tour very quickly. And that hasn't been the case. It's been tough going for him to a certain extent since then. Of course, he'll be competing or coexisting with João Almeida, who is the other favourite or the number one sort of outsider behind Vingegaard. And he's had a fantastic season, of course. Crashed out of the Tour de France when he'd started it pretty well. But prior to that, he'd had some good wins in one-week stage races. And he's also someone who is, he's sort of been expected for a long time to make the step up and finally win a Grand Tour, but has not done it yet. And until he does it, there will be that question mark over whether he will ever do it. But at this point, chaps, I'm just going to list the other GC contenders or GC riders who are at the Vuelta. Whether they are going for GC in this race is another matter. So Matteo Jorgensen and Sepp Kuss for Visma Lisa Bike. Derek G, I don't think Israel have announced their team yet, but we think he'll be in it. Almeida, Ayuso, Jai Hindley and Pellizzari for Red Bull. Bernal for Ineos. Tiberi for Bahrain, Felix Gall for Decathlon, Ciccone for Little Trek, Max Poole for Picnic Post NL, Landa for Sudal Quickstep, Fortunato for Astana, Romo, we mentioned him, for Movistar, and Gaudu for Groupama FDJ.
Do we not fancy Pellizzari?
Pellizzari, I mentioned him, Brian. I mentioned him.
Oh, sorry about that.
And Riquitello, or as he likes to be called, for Israel as well. We think he is going to be on the start list. No Roglic, of course. Until they announced their team a couple of days ago, I just did wonder about Primoz Roglic. I remember looking at his race days so far this year, and it's about the same. They're about the same as some riders that are going to be in this Vuelta and contending. I just wondered whether Rog had a sort of surprise up his sleeve. Not the case. He will not be at the Vuelta España. He will not be going for his fifth title. But chaps, anyone there that you can see threatening sort of Ayuso, Almeida, and particularly Vingegaard? There are a few, as I said, who have already said they're not going for GC. Ciccone not going for GC, which might be a surprise given the form that he's been in recently. But anyone else? Not really. Silence.
No. I mean, no. Not really seriously, right?
I think one will emerge. Right? There will be someone who we're not necessarily expecting to contend who will be right up there, I would suggest, 10 days in, 2 weeks in. There'll be a surprise, whether it's, you know, Ben O'Connor. I didn't mention Ben O'Connor, actually. He's also on the start list. Play the role that Ben O'Connor played last year. Jai Hindley, of course, has won a Grand Tour and he crashed out of the Giro d'Italia. He should be coming in fresh and well-prepared. Tiberi, same thing with him. He crashed out. Or did he crash out? Was he ill? He certainly didn't finish the Giro d'Italia. So again, he's been focusing on the Vuelta for a long time. Mikel Landa said he won't go for the general classification. He's going for stages. So I think there will be someone. I just don't know who it's
going
to be.
I would expect another rider that are not here in La Vuelta, another GC rider besides Roglic and Mas. I don't know if you guys know where. Yeah. Richard Carapaz would be probably another potential.
He would have been,
That's quite the stomach bug, though, huh?
It is. I sought some further information about this yesterday, Brian. Richard Carapaz, why is he not doing the Vuelta a España? And yeah, I was told that it is to do with, I think the team communicated this yesterday as well, that it is still to do with the illness that kept him out of the Tour de France. They felt that he was still undercooked for the Vuelta a España, which is very disappointing, to say the least. For that team, and I'm pretty sure they'll have a good race anyway. They come with some interesting mix of stage hunters, but it's a big pivot for them.
It is Markel Velocchi there, his first Grand Tour.
Yes, and things have been looking up for him recently because he'd struggled in the first 18 months as a pro, but did pretty well in Tour of Austria and also won the Tour Alsace, which is more of an under-23 race, but he won that.
What do you guys consider a good result for Egan Bernal?
A good result, maybe top five, but I think that's a tall order.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Top five would be, I would say, not a good, but a great result. And top 10 would be, or I would define it as a probably expected result, let's say.
Yeah.
If, I think if they get the, they should be able to propel him pretty well up there on the team time trial, shouldn't they?
Yep, with Ganna in the team, certainly. It's, yeah. It's a punchy route though, isn't it, chaps? It's an, you know, maybe slightly different from other years, but there is one characteristic of Welters that we see again this year, which is quite short climbs. Okay, La Farapone, 16 kilometers, the Angliru is pretty long, but there are a lot of sort of 20-minute climbs, 10-minute climbs, and that is not necessarily Bernal's forte. I mean, it can be quite explosive, but there aren't the sort of huge sort of 5,000 meters of climbing and big kind of kilojoule days that you would maybe associate with Egan Bernal. I think it's going to be an interesting race for Ineos because it's looking, well, we've got a pretty damn good idea at this point who's going to be in their team next year. We don't think there are going to be any huge signings up their sleeve. I think Vorkelein is going to go there. But it's going to be another sort of grand tour of not really knowing what the future direction of that team is as far as GC is concerned. So I think there's pressure is going to be on them. The pressure is going to be on them to win stages and more than one stage as well. We should also mention the sprinters. The few sprinters there are going to be. Mads Pedersen, we mentioned him, Brian. He could clean up, couldn't he? Certainly, the few opportunities that there are. Jasper Philipsen, we expect to be on the start list. Not confirmed yet, but we're pretty sure that he is going to be going to the Vuelta a España. Won't have many opportunities. And after that, well, it's pretty bare. Coca is going to be there for Cofidis. Aular for Movistar. Anjokowski for Cofidis. Viviani for Lotto. But otherwise, not too much in the way of sprinting pedigree. I expect Picnic Post NL to pick one of their fast riders as well. Ethan Vernon as well for Israel Premier Tech. But not too much else. Do you know the GC rider I didn't mention, chaps? I didn't mention. I'm going to march myself off to Corrections Corner. And this is worth just a quick discussion, I think. Tom Pidcock. In a Vuelta, which seems to suit him perfectly in terms of stage hunting opportunities. I mentioned those explosive uphill finishes. I could see at least three or four that would ordinarily suit him. He wants to give the GC another go. And this has caused some raised eyebrows, I would suggest.
I mean, oftentimes when riders come with these declarations and people raise their eyebrows, if they back themselves, they have pretty first access to their own possibilities. That they've been looking at the numbers, they've been doing the training, they've been at altitude and whatnot, and they're the first people to be put in the corner if they don't succeed. So I mean, it is a big ask to go for GC at the Vuelta, regardless of whom else is racing it. So if he believes in it himself, it's a pretty good indicator of where he is right now, isn't it?
Fair enough.
No, I'm not asking you to take it back.
No. I think he'll probably have a very good race, and he does have the safety.
Yeah.
Look, if things aren't going well after a week, then he can easily pivot, and there are plenty of opportunities left. I think there will be a lot of opportunities for breakaways in this Vuelta a España, as there often are. But chaps, that almost concludes our Vuelta preview. As ever on this Vuelta a España, as ever on all of our Grand Tours, we are going to be celebrating not only the cycling of Spain, but the wine of Spain. We've teamed up with Divine Cellars of London to offer a case showcasing the terroir of the Vuelta a España, the wine growing prowess of Spain and Spaniards. Let's hear, shall we, briefly from Greg Andrews of Divine Cellars. He's going to tell you a bit about this year's case.
Hi, this is Gregory Andrews from Divine Cellars. Here to talk about the Cycling Podcast 25 case, which starts in Rioja with the Vino Centenario Joven, 100% Tempranillo, really nice, fresh, juicy, easy drinking. We then get on to Chacolí, you know, up in the Basque Country, where we have a really fresh, spritzy chacoli, perfect to refresh yourself or even to go with some seafood. Then we work on our way down the coast to Rias Baias, where we have the Seven Shepherd Albariño. Again, benchmark Albariño, really great style. And then we climb into the mountains with the Ribera Sacra, looking at sort of the Matiolo Tinto, which is 100% Mancia, really delicious wine. Then on to Rueda, of course, we've got to do Videa there with an absolutely stunning herbaceous stone fruit tinged wine. And then finally, we finish in Gredos with an absolutely stunning Garnacha from 120-year-old vines. Absolutely amazing. We hope you enjoy.
So UK listeners can go to Divine Cellars. That's D, the letter D, vinecellars.com to find out how they can acquire this year's Vuelta case. I am going to be traveling to Turin on Friday. I'm going to be meeting up with Michele Pelacci. And from Saturday, we're going to be having daily podcasts, which should be landing a couple of hours after the stage, 2-3 hours after the stage. I'll be catching up with you, Brian, in week 2 and you, Danny, in week 3. I was going to also ask you for a nomination for breakout star of the Vuelta a España, but Danny, maybe you're going to be my breakout star of this year's Vuelta a España. If it's not you and you flop horribly, which you're not going to do, you're going to be just great, then the breakout star, I think, it's going to be Leo Bissiou of Decathlon, who was excellent in the Tour of Burgos.
He did it great in Burgos. I have another name. In Burgos, which is the team I think I'm going to supply what Kern Pharma did last year. Of course, not with that success. But I'm going to say Hugo de la Calle, which is a 21-year-old, first year as a pro, fourth in the last Vuelta Asturias. He's from there. So let's have him as a name to follow.
Spanish rider. That team is also fielding one of two Uruguayans in the Vuelta field this year. It's quite a broad range of South Americans this year, because there's also a Guatemalan riding for Burgos Biache.
Sergio Chumil.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We don't have maybe the strength in sort of numbers of the Colombians and the Colombian challenge that we've had in previous years. Not quite. We don't have a Colombian potential winner, I don't think. But yeah, some interesting representatives of other South American nations who we'll try to catch up with them and maybe grab a chat with them, so we can find out a bit more about where they come from and how they made it to the Vuelta a España. But chaps, on that note, I'm going to thank you for your time today. And well, we'll be seeing you, hearing from you in not many days.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Thank you.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
This Labor Day at Lowe's, shop member-only doorbuster deals for a limited time. Save $50 on an Ego string trimmer, now $169. Plus, get 50% off select Holland pavers. Not a rewards member? Sign up for free today. But hurry, Labor Day doorbuster deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 9/1 while supplies last. Program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.